Many disposable plastic products can take hundreds of years to decompose, filling up lakes and landfills in Illinois. We'll talk about proposed state bills that limit plastic waste. And Golden Apple Foundation President Alan Mather and his organization are working on ways to help address the teacher shortage here in Illinois. We'll hear from him about what else he would like to see done. Plus, when it comes to virtual reality, most people think of entertainment, but we'll hear from a researcher who thinks it's an opportunity to level the playing field for people with disabilities.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. Convenience. If there were ever a word to summarize a lot of our motivations, that would be it. And the economy has obliged. Perhaps the clearest sign of that is disposable plastic, from disposable cups to takeout containers or coffee stirrers. But it takes 400 years for each of these little conveniences to break down naturally. In the meantime, a lot ends up in Midwestern lakes and rivers. Senator Melinda Bush represents Illinois' 31st district in the General Assembly. The district is located near Lake Michigan. She's co-sponsoring about a half dozen bills to limit plastic waste. 21st show producer Julian Haida recently spoke with her and Leila Acharoglu, a designer, sociologist, and a United Nations Champion of the Earth Award winner. Julian started by asking the state senator why she sponsored the legislation.
We've gotten to a place where we use these things for convenience. We have plastic bottles, you know, that are being used for water. You know, when you can drink out of a paper cup that's recyclable, or you can buy a cup, or you can drink out of a water fountain. So we're looking at a deposit on single-use plastics and bottles. There are a lot of states that do that. We're also doing a plastic bag bill. Many people call that a fee. I call it an incentive. Really trying to incentivize people to not purchase a plastic bag, but to bring their own bags, obviously. You know, so we're not sending those bags to the waste stream. There's also a bill that's been introduced this year that would ban plastic straws, which certainly they're a problem also, but maybe a little bit more symbolic. I think that there's also, I believe, another bill someone else has other than myself that would limit the use of plastics for to-go food and also limit our own state facilities from using those kinds of items. So 1,500 plastic shopping bags are used a year by the average family in the United States, and I think 1% of those actually gets returned for recycling. So those are going into our landfills and into our rivers and into our water, and you know, I believe that single-use plastics has been just really a scourge on the environment and for us as humans.
So it sounds like you're trying to incentivize recycling while also trying to incentivize reuse of certain products.
Absolutely.
So, Leila, you know, it seems like the approach here in Illinois is a good start. It's pretty holistic. But you think that it's important to focus on design as well. What are some of the ways that you think that some of these issues kind of slip through the cracks with regards to sustainability?
When it comes to something as complicated or as pervasive as plastic products in our natural environment and also our entire economy, we need to look at the full picture. And so, of course, plastic leaking into waterways is an absolutely tremendously terrible thing, because not only does it get ingested by sea life that you or I might end up eating, but also it slowly degrades into microplastics, which then make their way into, you know, the food chain, whether it be in salt. You know, there's studies that show that nearly all table salts have microbeads in them from decaying different plastics. So obviously there's the human health impact as well as the marine and natural environment impact. So these are really important issues for us to address. The bigger problem, though, is what we are replacing the products with when we put in legislation that changes the available resources. So, for example, when you put in a bag ban for plastic bags, and the alternative that the retailer or the customer then chooses is paper, then you will increase the overall environmental impact, because the production of paper product obviously still has an impact, but it's actually got to do with the amount of material required to achieve the functionality of carrying the item. Now, this does not mean the solution is to maintain plastic bags. It means that we have to look at it from a full perspective around the functionality of moving goods from your supermarket to your home. And then we need to think of solutions that are what we call closed loop, the circular economy, a whole movement around delivering goods and services so that you and I get our needs met, that it's not uncomfortable for us, but that it's actually with the best preferable outcome for the environment and for the economic impact on the individual. Now, the thing that's often not thought about when we're looking at any disposable product, any single-use product, be it plastic or metal or glass, is that it actually is a huge cost to the average citizen. So you or I are paying for the waste management system to come and collect waste from our houses. So when a producer or a company, say a retail company, chooses to fight against legislation or any design changes, essentially they're putting the cost, the burden of dealing with that waste onto the everyday citizen, which is pretty unfair if you ask me. And so this is one of the bigger motivators for us to actually not just ban things, but to incentivize producers to change the way they create goods and services so that, again, we get portable drinks. You know, we all like to have something that's easy to grab on the go and take to our workplace or whatever. But how can we close the loop? And there are heaps of examples of this where essentially single use is designed out of the system and the functionality of containing liquid or moving goods from a supermarket to your home and back again can be done so in reusable high-value packaging that de-incentivizes waste. So there's multiple benefits to strategies like this. Now, these are more complicated systems for sure. They do take longer and have a little bit more of a cost outlay. But when you can get forward-thinking companies on board and providers, and you've got legislators who are willing to kind of push at the envelope, these are the systems changes that we need. They're more equitable, meaning they're more financially fair and just to everyday citizens. And it means that the cost of pollution is not paid for by you or I, it's paid for appropriately by those who are actually doing the pollution, which is the producers and the retailers and the companies that are making these decisions to replicate these disposable systems.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Leila Acharolu. She's a designer, sociologist, and a United Nations Champion of the Earth Award winner. And also on the line with us is Senator Melinda Bush. She's a member of the Illinois Senate from the 31st District. Senator, I wanted to ask you now, Illinois only has two municipalities, Chicago and Evanston, that limit the use of disposables. So, and to Layla's point, you get fined for use of paper or plastic in those places, $0.07. As a lawmaker, how do you think ahead in the way that Layla's kind of proposing?
These are, you know, some sea changes in some ways for communities and companies. However, we believe it's really important that we move forward. But I do think that we need to be working across the state, not just with the advocates that are supporters, but also with the businesses. Frankly, I had a meeting with Walmart that I was truly surprised. I expected that meeting. They made an appointment with me to talk about the legislation. I expected that meeting to be about their opposition to the bills and their opposition and, you know, the things that they wanted to see. And frankly, I was shocked that they wanted to support the legislation and wanted to be helpful in, you know, in figuring out how we can actually get this done, because it's much easier for a business to have the laws be the same across the state, you know, so that their stores aren't dealing with one thing in Chicago, another thing in Evanston, you know, and another thing in Rockford. So that continuity across the state is actually really important to them. And I think that businesses are beginning to see and participate in our environment. There certainly are challenges. You know, the sad thing is the minute you start talking about these things, you have a group of people that start to just attack you and others that are trying to come up with real policies that are reducing our waste streams, reducing our use of single-use plastics. And their message is, we're taxing them. And that's not what this is about. This is about reducing our use. This is about getting us to a place where we are using materials that are sustainable, reusable, and we're, as consumers, we're supporting, you know, our own world and, as she so accurately said, our own economy and our own pocketbook. I grew up in a time where We drank out of glass bottles. We returned them to our grocery stores. You know, they were washed and they came back and they were refilled with the same product. You know, there's certainly questions about those manufacturing issues, but ultimately those that are making these items, the plastic bottles, the plastic bags, and using them are ultimately responsible and have to be paying their fair share.
Now, Layla, we heard a little bit about some of the resistance, and I mean, both Senator Bush and you outlined the kind of the very real economic realities of dealing with waste. But you know, these issues aren't coming very quickly. 13 states in the United States completely don't allow for any sort of disposable regulation. So the systemic dependence on disposables is obviously a huge issue. How do you fight that resistance, Layla?
Yeah, and this is a long, like, story, okay? So disposability offers not just convenience, but also a sense of safety around hygiene and cleanliness. And so the history of disposability is very much connected to this idea of being able to essentially feel secure in your community. So there's a lot of people who really dislike the idea of being inconvenienced in their perspective by having to reuse or to have to think ahead and perhaps take their own product. Or the idea of something being rewashed, they don't see that as sanitized. And so there's a lot of misconceptions that exist in the community about the pathway towards a more sustainable supply chain, which is what we're talking about here ultimately. But you see, the thing for me is that I study change, and the thing about change is that a lot of people think it's hard because they get scared of what they don't know. So people are overwhelmed a lot of the time by the idea that someone's taking something away from them. So it's called loss aversion in the psychological cognitive biases space. And so what we have to try and do when we're introducing new concepts to the community is ensure them that that this isn't something that's being taken away from them. It is an option that is going to be beneficial for them and everybody else in the long run. And not just on environmental measures. Like I said, there is clear economic benefits when you look at the whole picture, because the cost of waste management is astronomical. In 2018, China introduced the Golden Sword policy, which means that they no longer would receive the world's recyclable materials. So the recycling industry since then has essentially been in a complete chaotic state. And so the global recycling market has become very turbulent. And so incentives that just increase recycling are not even really going to create the benefit. We actually need to develop these whole closed system solutions. And to the senator's point about big organizations like Walmart, and some of the people that I work with, some of the world's biggest producers, they are at the forefront of this, because they don't only see it as the right thing to do as against like the sustainable development goals and these ideas of like, how do we do good as a corporate citizen? But also it makes sense economically, because again, waste management, whether it be in the products that they're having delivered to their stores and having to pay for the removal of that waste from their stores, or as a kind of global industry, waste management is really expensive. You know, we burn things, we put it in holes in the ground, or we try to recycle it. But globally, only 9% of all plastic ever produced has ever been recycled. 9%. So, you know, the state of the affairs is that since the 1960s, when plastic was introduced, that's only you know, 60-something years ago, we have dramatically integrated this product into our supply chain. Now, it is an incredible material. It actually saves people's lives, because in the medical industry, it's so important. So we shouldn't vilify the actual material. We should figure out when and how to use it appropriately so that it's beneficial and so that the cost to the society is not greater than the benefit. There's always going to be resistance. I mean, the history of the disposable beverage use is a history of Keep America Beautiful. And this is well documented, that that was a lobby group from a coalition of different beverage companies in the 1950s set up to enable the easy transition from the reusable systems that the senator was talking about that were prominent. You know, you used to have your soda or your milk delivered in reusable containers. Lobby group set up to help redirect the use to disposable and make it all about the individual's responsibility to not litter versus the industry's responsibility to provide safe and sustainable products into the marketplace. So, but this is all changing right now.
So, Senator, for the last word, do you hope that a lot of these integrated solutions will come not only to Illinois, but the United States?
I am so hopeful. You know, I do believe we're moving in the right direction. I do believe we are going to finally pass some pieces of legislation. Really, all of us believe that those plastic drink bottles, those bags that we're putting into recycling containers, were actually being reused. We know that most of them aren't. You know, what happened is, you know, the virgin market for plastics, the manufacturers can buy virgin materials cheaper than they can buy recycled materials. I do have one question. I don't know if we'll have time. From Layla, I'd like to know what your thoughts are as we're seeing our consumers changing how they're purchasing groceries, et cetera. We have more people that are having delivery, that those things are coming to their homes. You know, how are we going to make sure that they're not using single-use items for delivery? Have you seen anything, any conversations about that going on?
So there's two great examples I can provide. One is in New York. It's called the Loop System. It was a collaboration between TerraCycle and Unilever, and it's delivering to customers who sign up anything from your ice cream to your dishwashing liquid in fully reusable containers. So you get them delivered. When you finish, they get picked up, refilled, and replaced with reusables. That system's actually being rolled out in other parts of the US and also in Europe. You also have a great example in Berkeley. It's called Vessel. It's a reusable coffee cup system that's basically based off a library system. So you go to a coffee shop, you grab a coffee, you check it out, you check the coffee cup out, you can drop it in any on the street like a receptacle that then basically takes them, washes them, and that means that you don't have to have your to-go cup on you. You can have like a reusable one. You can just kind of subscribe to this system. So we're seeing examples like that pop up all over the world. And so that's the really exciting thing that's happening right now, is that there are a lot more creative approaches to addressing this, and in a way that makes it much more enjoyable for us as consumers. The pathway to change then is a lot less, rickety. It's kind of more enjoyable. So there are lots of examples. There are also lots of work that still needs to be done in finding these solutions. And there's a huge economic opportunity for those industries that are willing to take this on and move forward with it. Because at the end of the day, you know, finite resources like plastics and other materials, they become economically unviable to waste at some point. So there's a lot of economic motivation behind this change, as well as the environmental and the social benefits.
That was Layla Ajiroglu, a designer, sociologist, and a United Nations Champion of the Earth Award winner. You also heard from Senator Melinda Bush from Illinois' 31st District, speaking with 21st show producer Julian Haida. I'm Jenna Dooley. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. Educators and students across Illinois have struggled with a teacher shortage for years, and it's a problem that our state will continue to face for the foreseeable future. Right now, that shortage is estimated at 1,800 educators. The number is projected to be closer to 20,000 by the year 2025. The Golden Apple Foundation is one of several organizations hoping to help address the statewide deficits. Now the organization has launched a new program which will help to provide funding and also training new teachers for areas with the highest need in the state. Lee Gaines sat down with Golden Apple Foundation President Alan Mather last week. He was in Champaign for the Illinois New Teacher Collaborative Conference.
By now, a lot of our listeners are aware that there's a teacher shortage in Illinois, but does the need for teachers look different depending on what part of the state you're in?
Absolutely. I mean, both urban areas and rural areas are being hit hardest by the teacher shortage.
Okay. And what about certain subject areas? Like I'm thinking special ed in particular.
Special education, STEM fields, bilingual education is increasingly becoming difficult to fill. There are many areas. I've been surprised, actually, when meeting with superintendents and principals that some say I can't find a second grade teacher or a high school English teacher.
Wow. So what does this mean, though? I think so. It's one thing to say that we have a teacher shortage and we have, you know, 1,000 or so unfilled positions and it's only going to get worse. But what does the actual impact on the classroom look like and feel like for the school district and also for the students in those rooms?
I think sometimes we think about classrooms that are empty, and instead we tend more to think about classrooms that are overcrowded because there aren't enough teachers to fill them. So the students have to be placed somewhere. But in other cases, it means loss of enrichment. It means loss of prepared science teachers. It really does impact a student's ability to get a great education.
Are there any particular stories that you've heard, maybe from some districts in central and southern Illinois, that have just kind of stuck with you as you continue to tackle and think about the teacher shortage?
So yesterday I was at Egyptian High School in Tams, Illinois, down in Little Egypt area. And this is a school that has had declining enrollment, 20% drop in the last 5 years. There's been consolidation of schools, and this is a K through 12 district now of 412 students. Three of the teaching positions the principal has are being filled by retired teachers, not who want to keep going, but know that otherwise students wouldn't have this class. They wouldn't be able to take this this course at all. A science class is being taught, or all science classes are being taught by someone with an environmental science degree, but he's teaching biology, chemistry, and physics, a little bit outside of his realm. So students are obviously being having their education kind of cut short, and it's no fault of anybody there. It's just they cannot find the teachers to come into those communities.
So let's talk about the reasons why. I think that's a nice segue and unpack that. My understanding from reporting on this issue is that, you know, there's several reasons. Compensation, though, is one of them. So do you think that the passage recently of the new teacher minimum wage of $40,000 by 2023 will make a difference here?
I think it's a great start. Certainly, compensation is one of the issues that surrounds the teacher shortage. We hear, particularly in poorer rural communities, the issue of poaching by higher-paid districts. So if lower-paying districts cannot keep somebody because someone else can pay more, that's obviously an issue.
Yeah. But what else needs to happen to solve the shortage besides increasing pay rates for people? Because I know that, you know, there are teachers in some parts of the state that aren't yet making $40,000, but there's already teachers making well over $40,000 in other parts of the state, particularly around the Chicago area.
Yeah, and certainly that is just one piece of the puzzle. I mean, there are so many reasons for the teacher shortage. I don't know that we could get into them all, but I do think that teaching has become a bit of a profession that has become a punching bag, right? I mean, there are, if you want to blame something on some problem in society, I think teachers are an easy place to turn. The original kind of accountability measures, I think accountability measures are good, but I think they went too far to rely on a single test to for a while, and that's, of course, changed, but for a while it was a single test to measure the effectiveness of a teacher or a school. But I just don't think we've elevated the teaching profession the way it needs to be. Mm. There has been a loss of respect for it, and you know we need to honor the profession of teachers. A teacher may feel honored within that classroom by his or her students, but we need to elevate that more societally.
So I think it's indisputable, though, that teachers are crucial and people value the role that they play in society. So how do you restore respect to the profession? Do you have any ideas for what needs to be done on that front? And who's sort of responsible for doing it? Is it the teachers themselves or is it the general public?
I think everyone's responsible in one form or another. But you know, teaching is a weird profession. Everybody is an expert because everybody went to school. And so some of this is how do we really kind of turn over some of the power to the school, to the teacher, to the principal to say, you know, I trust you to do right by my child. Not that you don't need to advocate. You should advocate for your child when something has gone wrong. But sometimes there's a little bit too much advocacy going on.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about the solutions, and you touched on some there. Can you tell me a little bit more about the Golden Apple Accelerators program? What is that?
So this is a new program that we've launched for Southern, Central, and Western Illinois. What we're doing is recruiting people from Southern, Central, and Western Illinois who live in the communities of the schools, and we have some target communities we're working with this first year, some very specific communities where we're recruiting those with bachelor's degrees. They will be able to go through a one-year residency program. While they're going through that residency, they'll be able to take courses primarily online at either Blackburn College or Eastern Illinois University, and in that 1 year, get a teaching license. They can be teachers of record in year two, being mentored, by a teacher in the school and in their first 2 years of teaching being mentored by Golden Apple mentors.
So is this for people who hadn't previously considered teaching as a potential career path and are, you know, suddenly inspired to look into it? How are you targeting those individuals?
So there's a couple ways we're targeting them. And first, you know, there are a lot of people who went into jobs to make money and now are looking for meaning in their lives. And teaching does provide meaning. As someone who was in the profession for 33 years, I can say that. So we are targeting, in many cases, those who are working in schools now but are not teachers. Paraprofessionals in special education classrooms have been a huge target audience, and many of our applications that have come in so far have been from paraprofessionals. We're also looking at seniors in college who did not think about teaching until their senior year, didn't go into colleges of education. But as a former principal, I hired a number of people who were career changers, and I can tell you, career changers bring something different, something exciting to the profession. You know, students often say, you know, when will I need to know this? Why is this meaningful to me? And career changers often have the answer to that and say, this is how you'll use that in the real world.
If you're just tuning into the 21st, I'm Lee Gaines. I've been speaking with Alan Mather. He is the president of the Golden Apple Foundation. Alan, can you tell me about another program that your foundation has? It's called the Golden Apple Scholars Program. What is that for our listeners who aren't already familiar?
So we recruit seniors in high school through sophomores in college. We provide $23,000 in tuition assistance. But I think more importantly, in the summers, we provide paid professional development for these young people we call our Golden Apple Scholars. At campuses around the state, we ensure that every one of our scholars gets an urban, a suburban, and a rural experience. So they are housed in different years in different campuses. They have hundreds of additional hours where they're teaching in summer schools across the state. And then they come back and learn from some of those master teachers we talked about, some of those who have been honored previously by Golden Apple or are what we call completed scholars, those who have fulfilled their 5 years of teaching in a school of need. So they prepare the next generation of teachers, because one of the other issues is teachers leave the profession quickly, right? Mm-hmm. 50% of teachers leave within the first 4 years. 82% of our scholars stay teaching in schools of need at least 5 years.
Wow.
And we want them to stay in the profession, right? The one other thing I would say about the Scholars Program is that we provide mentors in their first 2 years of teaching. Teaching, even though you're around all these students and, you know, lots of energy, it can be a lonely profession. And to have a group with whom you are connected, of other adults who understand what you're going through, who you can turn to and say, this lesson was terrible. I need to do something different. And to think through that, that's a lot of what our mentors provide.
Yeah, I do want to touch on this statistic, though, because I think it's shocking and also important for our listeners to realize, which is that only 15% of Illinois teachers are people of color, but more than 50% of Illinois students are of color. I'm curious how this particular program, the Golden Apple Scholars Program, aims to help address that discrepancy or that disparity.
No, thank you for asking. About 50% of our scholars are students of color, so they're going to be going into teaching and kind of addressing that disparity specifically. Also, about half of our scholars are first-generation college goers. So we are providing kind of a pathway to a career that had not been provided previously.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about why it's so important for teachers in the classroom to reflect the students that they're teaching.
Yeah, it's so impactful for students of color to see someone who looks like them. And this has been a refrain across the state. I was just in Cobden, Illinois, where the team name is the Apple Knockers. So the Cobden Apple Knockers, about a third of their student population now is Latinx, yet they only have one bilingual teacher in the elementary school and one in the high school. I was visiting a school in Harrisburg where the only person they could find to work with the bilingual students who had come in recently was a parent in the community who basically comes in and helps translate. And
wow.
The principal has done a wonderful job of preparing her to kind of facilitate what's happening in the classroom. But the need for bilingual teachers is dramatic. And even those who don't reflect the students, what sort of cultural competency do you need to go into a classroom? How do you not only understand the experience of your students, but you want to elevate it and celebrate that.
Yes, that's important. That's a conversation I hear many teachers around the state having. I'm wondering, are you aware of any other programs or any other measures that are happening in Illinois that you're hopeful about, that you think will actually make a dent in the shortage?
I'm really hopeful about what the state is talking about now on two fronts. One is Educators Rising is a new program that has been written into ISBE's budget. And this is a program that really starts middle school students through high school students who are interested in teaching and provides them preparation and a pathway to go into schools of education, colleges of education. So I think if we kind of grow our own through middle school and high school, kind of peel back the curtain a little bit of what pedagogy is and what it means to run a classroom. You know, when I went through my teacher ed program, I really didn't get into a classroom until I was a senior in college. And that's a horrible time if that's when you discover that you shouldn't be a teacher. So getting people earlier and really helping them understand what this profession is just one great path forward. The other thing is there's an idea that's floating in the state legislature around the seal of biliteracy. So taking our students who have earned the seal of biliteracy in the state.
What is the seal of biliteracy?
It's a program that recognizes and honors students who have shown proficiency in two languages, two or more languages, English and one other. And this may be for native English speakers who have become proficient in another language, but it's more commonly someone who has come to this country or speaks another language at home proficiently and has learned English to a proficient level. And so they earn the seal of biliteracy. And there's an idea floating out there of a $5,000 a year scholarship for recipients of the seal of biliteracy who are going into teaching.
And that will help address some of this extreme shortage that we have and the need for bilingual teachers.
Bilingual teachers and teachers of color in many cases, yes.
So I want to shift gears for a moment here. As you're aware, Governor J.B. Pritzker recently gave his annual budget address, and that includes about $7 billion for K-12 funding, including an extra $25 million in addition to the mandated $350 million annual minimum increase under our new-ish state funding formula. I'm curious what your reaction to his budget proposal as it relates to K-12 funding is.
It seems like there's been a true commitment to addressing the teacher shortage and to funding schools. I mean, the evidence-based funding piece alone, this is part of what rural schools are saying left and right, is this has helped them tremendously dig out of the hole they were in. Now, there's still a struggle finding teachers, right? So I've talked to some superintendents who said, I had to close world language classes. I had to close art and music classes. And now I have the funds to open those back up, but I can't find the teachers. So I think the efforts are the right efforts to move this forward. But I still think there needs to be support to, again, elevate the teaching profession to say, this is something for you, and to see teaching as a path to really changing people's lives. I mean, this is a social justice issue now. Teaching is a social justice issue, and we need to think of it that
way. Why do you say that? Why is it a social justice issue?
Because where the teacher shortage is most acute is in those high-poverty schools, again, whether urban or rural. And if you're going to kind of level the playing field, as you say, you need excellent teachers wherever you are. This becomes social justice because we have to have teachers who are going to change the trajectory of students' lives. And if they can't take science classes from someone who understands physics, if they can't have the opportunity for art and music classes that someone in a better funded district can have, then we're not coming close to the equity we espouse.
And lastly, Alan, I want to ask you about, for our listeners out there who are not a part of this profession but deeply value the role that teachers and particularly public education plays in the lives of their family and their children, what would you say to them? How can people outside of this profession support teachers?
I think there are so many ways. You know that teachers dig into their pockets all the time to fund things for classrooms. I mean, sometimes it's going and saying, what can I do to support you in the classroom? Where do you need help? What can I do to elevate the profession? I think they should nominate their favorite teachers for awards, like the Golden Apple Award, like the Illinois State Teacher of the Year. Show teachers that they are valued. Show that you honor what they do with your children and other people's children every day, and that you understand the impact that they have.
Alan Mather is president of the Golden Apple Foundation. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Lee Gaines with Golden Apple Foundation President Alan Mather. Last week, he was in Champaign for the Illinois New Teacher Collaborative Conference. I'm Jenna Dooley. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Jenna Dooley. When we think of virtual reality, you probably think of entertainment, putting on a headset and seeing a virtual 3D experience. But increasingly, researchers are using this technology to help individuals with disabilities navigate the real world. NPR Illinois' Mary Hansen recently spoke with Awal Ofek, a senior researcher at Microsoft in Redmond, Washington. He's working on making virtual and mixed reality more accessible and was at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for a lecture at the Coordinated Science Lab. Mary started by asking him about a device called the Dreamwalker. It allows users to use virtual reality as they walk between real-world locations.
Virtual reality has been around for decades. We probably think of putting on a headset and experiencing things in 3D, but you're working on something called the Dreamwalker that's maybe a little bit different. What exactly is it, and how is it different from what we usually think about when we think of virtual reality?
When people think of virtual reality, they basically think of the most common application, which is entertainment. You put on a headset and you're in a new environment, separate from your current everyday life and so on. What we look at it is an opportunity where people have right now access to rather non-expensive wearables that they can put on themselves, and by doing so, change the way their senses work, what they see, what they hear, what they touch. And this gives us a lot of new opportunities. It may, on one hand, level the playing field between people that have different qualities of sensing, enhance signals if you don't see well or have a problem hearing, or replace it with different senses. And on the other hand, you could maybe work better if you could see things that you cannot saw before, move quickly from one location to the other, and so on. There's a lot of possibilities in this.
And so what are some of the challenges that people with, I know you mentioned that there's a lot of opportunities here. What are some of the challenges that people with disabilities face that you think could be addressed with this type of virtual reality?
So we actually started from maybe the furthest away from what people think of virtual reality. Virtual reality, most people can imagine something which has great visuals that you put on and you're suddenly in a new place. What if the customer is actually blind? Then does virtual reality has anything to offer for such? And in fact, it does, because again, as we look at it, is a way that we could supply information for people. For blind people, it's mostly going to be through audio or haptics, touch. And by wearing it, we know several things. One, we know where is the person and where is he going. So we have more information around it. And then we look at ways that we can now represent that information for the person. For example, we had a project where people came in and they put on the equipment and they could simulate going into the street or a public train station. And they would experience the same environment as if they were in the real world. For example, if they use cane, then the cane will hit objects that do not exist, and they will hear the sound of the cane scrapping on the floor and so on. And they could learn how to find the pedestrian crossing and when is it safe to cross, or what will be my path to get from one point to another, again, without going to real environment where there might be danger.
So sort of a practice round. You're getting them used to the environment,
yes.
getting them acclimated without those risk factors of, you know, cars coming by or people.
That's right.
In that environment. And so how did you get into researching this topic?
Wow. So I did my PhD in computer vision. And after that, I did it in Israel. And seems like a way to grow up there is to start your own startup company. So I started several. And the last one of them, we built up a depth camera that was sensing just like regular camera that sends light and see what's around it. This sense the distance all around you and represent that. And we were looking at different applications, starting from really big application because it was expensive and new, up until getting to really cheap applications like gaming, like Kinect. And eventually we found the camera be part of the HoloLens augmented reality. So it's already there, set out the direction toward that. And one thing that you do see when you try to do new stuff, new technology, is how long it takes for it to get to the public. This one was rather short, about 15 years. But
That does sound short.
Yes, but virtual reality was already existing 50 years, and only now it's getting to maybe prices that a consumer buys.
Yeah, more accessible for people to enjoy. And so you talked about, as you mentioned, it's been around for decades, and you talk about virtual and wild, this sort of two different yeah. terms that sound that are could be opposites. And I wonder why you talk about your research in that way.
Yes. So whenever you So using wearables like virtual reality right now is mostly aimed at very specific experiences. I go to a room, usually an empty room or that doesn't have any things that I might trip on. And I put on a headset and I play for 20 minutes and then I take it off and I get out of the room. And we were thinking, what will it be if I will never, for that discussion, I'll say I will never take it off. I actually go out. On one hand, this is extremely dangerous. The world outside, it's not managed by anyone, and a dog might run under my feet, and I cannot control what's around me. But on the other hand, it gives a lot of opportunity for additional information to come in and modify the way that I'm working or playing or interacting. So that's why we call it the wild.
So you're sort of bringing those virtual elements out into everyday life, out into sort of the messiness, into the wild.
Yes. And it's so fascinating. You can look at different ways that people interacting. I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm talking with you and we have some social rules between us. If, say, I want to look at my watch to see how much time we still have, you might regard it as, oh, he's really being bored or things like that. I want to access that information without the social impact. So maybe I will say, oh, whenever I look at the corner of a room, I will see how much time I still have. And you will not know, right? Sounds horrible. It's a way to have a parallel channels while we're talking, right? But the fact is that you can do a lot of things that will help people. And again, leveling the play field. So we took different people and we tried to see if we can improve the conversation or at least the beginning of the conversation between them, though people never met.
Yeah, and sort of break down some barriers.
Yes, and say if I infuse information to the conversation, would that help? And it's very interesting because you can see some people that totally hate it. They have no problem in generating connection and talking. Well, some people more toward the introvert part of actually using it.
Yeah.
So again, I'm trying to think of ways that the fact that we modify the senses could help people. We're not equal. Everyone has some limitations and things like that. Can we make ourselves better?
So these are some of the positive things, some of the opportunities that could come out of this. But there's also a lot of debate and discussion around virtual reality. And especially as these technologies get more real and you know, improve. I wanted to talk a little bit about the uncanny valley. For our listeners who might not be familiar with this topic, could you talk a little bit about what the uncanny valley is when you talk about robots, for example? I think that's usually what it's associated with.
Yeah, or animation.
Right, or animation.
Well, uncanny valley was, it's funny, it was discovered when people were building up animation or computer games, and gradually their fidelity and graphics become better and better and better. And suddenly you saw that there was a drop in satisfaction of users. I mean, the graphics becoming better and the satisfaction drops down. And people look at what happened. And what really happens is that when as you getting closer and closer to reality, and in our case, mostly when you render people to get people more and more realistic, you become extremely sensitive to any differences between different senses. For example, it might be that I see a person that looks very realistic, but his motion is a bit mechanical. I feel like something
you,
is
you hyper-focus
bad.
On right. that in one piece.
Yeah, or the voice doesn't fit, or things which, as long as things were caricaturistic or less realistic, you didn't mind. But as you get into reality, you get that.
And so how does that connect then to when we're talking about virtual reality and the headsets and the things that you're talking about?
Yes. So we right now replace all our senses. We show visuals which are really becoming really pretty and fantastic. We render audio all around us, and we can feel where the source of the audio comes in, but we cannot render all our senses the same way, and particularly touch. Touch is very problematic. And you might see a wonderful butterfly flies around you, and you reach with your hand to touch that butterfly, and it's not there. And when it's not there, then becomes this clash between different representations. On one hand, I see it. On the other hand, I don't touch it.
Yeah.
So what we saw was in a very similar way that was for visuals. Also, other senses may generate this uncanny valley.
So is that something that you have to overcome as you're developing the different uses for this, or is it more just a part of the experience?
Well, we are on a progressing path to get more better and better rendering, but we almost hardly get to the ultimate things that will feel our senses. So we have to be aware of that. We have to make sure that we, whenever we serve something, it will have all the senses that could be served with it. For example, if I cannot render a soft cushion for the chair, I maybe want to avoid people touching it because they might have expectation for that. And that once the expectation are not met when they touch, it generates this uncanny valley phenomena.
And people are not satisfied with
yes.
it. And so getting back to this technology, how far do you think we are from making it accessible right now? It seems like the cost is falling for VR equipment is still pretty expensive or bulky. When might we see people sort of walking around and using this in the real world as you hope?
First, the first thing that people see is the hardware. The hardware is progressing really fast. We see more and more devices coming to the market, and those devices becoming smaller and gradually cheaper. And we can already see devices that very much looks like glasses that you put on your head. This is great. It's not the end of the line. It needs to be very light and good quality and battery for a long and so on. What I'm looking at was other issues that more about the design of the applications around it. For example, let's say that I put on glasses and now I want to do some task, maybe I play a game. And when I'm looking at the world around me is part of that game. It's not that I'm playing a game on an Xbox or a computer or on a phone. The game is happening here. So it could be different if I have a table here in the middle, and if I want to get to a virtual character on the other side of the table versus if I'm in open space. And this means that whatever we are planning around us is not just cookie cut for all users. It needs to be different for every user, depending on the environment around him, are there other people, and so on. And this is a challenging concept for building up of applications. And that's what we are trying to do. And among that is what the capabilities of the users, would that be annoying to other users around that don't wear anything, and safety and so on.
So all of those sort of, yes. When you bring it in the real right. world, all those complications. Well, Eyal, it's been lovely talking to you. Eyal Ofek is a senior researcher with Microsoft. Thanks so much for being on the 21st.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Jenna Dooley. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.